Red Flag Laws. 15 states and the District of Columbia already have some version of what are referred to as red flag laws. Also called extreme risk protective orders, these laws enable courts to temporarily remove guns from people who are deemed dangerous to themselves or others. Several states passed red flag laws after school shootings in their states. Advocates say they are an important tool for law enforcement to prevent mass shootings and suicides. Opponents worry that they violate individual rights and may prevent some people from seeking help for mental illness. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The Maine legislature is currently considering a red flag bill, and another compromise measure is expected this week. We'll discuss what these laws would do and how they fit into the larger discussion about red flag laws. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. More and more states are passing so-called red flag laws, and Maine might be next. The laws enable courts to remove firearms from those who are seen as dangerous to themselves or others. We're going to discuss that today. Joining me in the studio, Dimitri Baum, who is Professor and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the University of Maine School of Law. Jeff Bickford is Director of Maine Gun Safety Coalition. And David Trahan is Executive Director of the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you think of the concept of red flag laws? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Again, a brief email. I will not read a long one. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. This is such an interesting and important issue and has so many layers to it, I'm learning. So I'm going to start with you, Jeff. I understand that you helped draft the red flag bill that was introduced already this session. Can you talk a little bit about red flag laws in general, what they are, what they look like around the country, and what they're intended to do?
Sure. And thank you very much for having us on today to discuss this important topic. So a red flag law is not something that's new. As you noted, these have been passed around across the United States, signed into law, notably by a lot of Republican governors. What these bills do is empower the police or a family member to petition a court when they have someone in their life, a family member, that they understand is going through some sort of crisis, not necessarily rising to the level of a mental illness, but it could be a temporary bout of depression or some other issue that makes them a danger to themselves or others, and these are folks that have access to firearms. And a family member can go in and say to a judge, I have this concern about this person. This is why I have the concern. They're recently divorced, recently laid off. They've made some indications that they may be suicidal or may be wanting to engage in some kind of dangerous activity outside of the home. And what I'm asking for, the family member's asking for, is a temporary order that would allow from the court that would allow the police to remove the firearms from the home. In Maine's case, up for no longer than 14 days before they would return for hearing.
That was going to be one of my questions. What is temporary? Right. In Maine's case, 14 days. Before I move on to our other guests, I need to ask you, what do we know about how effective these laws are?
Sure. Well, we know that they're effective for a variety of reasons. First of all, there have been studies done that have shown the rate of firearm suicide has been reduced in Connecticut and Indiana, two states that have passed these bills. Connecticut's law is dozens of years old, so there's strong anecdotal evidence and statistical evidence that show that these bills save lives. It's common sense that if the police are allowed to or family member are allowed to intercede and keep someone from harming themselves or others in this particularly period of acute crisis. Then we know that they work for that reason. And it's tough to prove a negative because you can't say, well, how many mass shootings have been prevented, how many suicides have been prevented. But we know that they do work, and we do have statistical proof that they work.
Sure. Okay, David, moving to you, you have some concerns about red flag laws. I understand you're not against every possible red flag law there is, but what are some of the concerns that you and others have about red flag laws?
Sure. Well, thank you for inviting me to discuss this, I think, very important issue and one that we want to be engaged in. Well, first of all, you know, Jeff's job is to put the best spin he possibly can on any policy. That's his job. And it's my job to come in and point out what we see as the other sides of that and try to, at the end, come up with a good policy. That's what we do. We debate in Maine. We try to come up with a good solution. The red flag bill that has been presented, when we testified, we pointed out some due process issues. We felt that the proposal in front of the legislature now was blatantly unconstitutional. It's a civil statute, and basically what is allowed, and there is a very broad definition of a family member to include past lovers, ex-spouse. It's very broad, so pretty much anybody who's connected to a person can bring a red flag order. In addition to that, police officers are authorized to do a red flag order, which means anybody can go to a police officer and then seek a red flag order. So basically anybody.
So your concern is that this wouldn't be something that, when you say due process, is similar to other cases that are brought before a judge.
Correct. And I can speak to the due process issues. First of all, this red flag order is done through what's called an ex parte process. That's without your knowledge. You don't have an opportunity to defend yourself, come in and argue why, you know, this ex-girlfriend has got it in for me. So you get this red flag order. Somebody shows up, a police officer shows up, and it can be 5 o'clock in the morning, just like what happened in Maryland, which led to the death of the person the order was served on, and say, you know what, the court wants your guns. And in the case of this, what's, I think, the most glaring piece that's unconstitutional is when the red flag order is authorized by the court, this statute calls for a simultaneous search warrant. This is a civil case, and there is no evidence of a crime, no evidence that a crime was committed in the place for the search warrant to be authorized and implemented. And when I pointed that out at the public hearing, some eyebrows went up. After 9/11, when we had the Patriot Act, there were a bunch of provisions passed. The courts rejected a warrantless search. There has to be probable cause to go into somebody's home to search it. And I believe that that's going to be struck from the bill, which points
out
the
fact. And we'll talk about that.
Yes.
I want to talk about both the Maryland case that you referred
yes.
to and also Maine's specific law in just a minute, but I want to get Dimitri in on the conversation. David mentioned a number of constitutional issues that are discussed, but there are red flag laws in place. So talk about how these constitutional issues have played out in states that do have red flag laws.
Yeah, so there are certainly various constitutional provisions that could be implicated, right? So obviously there is the kind of right to own weapons, right? So the Second Amendment right. And it's state analog, right? So the Maine Constitution has a very absolute provision about weapons ownership. So that's one that's potentially implicated. And then certainly due process concerns. Now, what I would say is with all of these rights, there's a kind of a balancing test to look at what the societal interests are that are at stake and what the potential consequences are, right? So, you know, David mentions ex parte proceedings. When we talk about due process, the court looks at the strength of the right in trying to decide what the proper procedure is and what the benefits are of a certain procedure that's used. And so ex parte proceedings are not themselves a violation of due process. It's a kind of a balancing analysis where we try to figure out what is the consequence of not following this process. Is there a better process that would have the same results, right? And so that's what courts often do when they're doing constitutional analysis under the Due Process Clause. Under the Second Amendment as well, and I can talk more about that.
All right. Well, I want to turn now to Senator Rebecca Millett. She's on the line with us now. She's the Democratic State Senator from Cape Elizabeth who introduced the red flag bill that is before the Maine legislature currently. Thanks for calling in, Senator Millett.
My pleasure.
Talk about the bill that you introduced and what motivated you to press for this law.
Red flag law or extreme risk protection law gives family members and law enforcement a way to intervene and prevent a tragedy. The gun safety measure that I proposed protects people's rights, but it also gives loved ones and law enforcement the tools they need to temporarily remove firearms from a dangerous situation. And I do want to reiterate that these laws have passed in 18 states. They have withstood court challenges. And they have earned the support of Republicans, Democrats, and independents alike because they make sense and save lives. I submitted this bill because I have sat in the Education Committee my full 6 years as state senator. We talk a lot about kids and protecting them and making sure and ensuring their well-being. And, you know, what we're doing to our children is completely unacceptable. They are being trained at young ages to go into bathrooms and stand on toilets and not make a sound for fear of being shot. This last weekend in Portland, dozens of school kids played victims as part of an active shooter drill, and they were smeared with fake blood. With first responders there, some armed, heavily armed. Our kids all across the state are learning what to do if someone with a gun comes into their school, and parents have to live with a fear that it's not a matter of if, but when. They will get a dreaded call about a school shooting. And that shows in the polls that have been taken here in Maine. We have over 80% support of red flag laws, and that's bipartisan. 70% of Republicans statewide support red flag. That's why I put it in.
Senator Millett, if you don't mind, stay on the line for just a minute. I want to ask David Trahan about the other bill that he sees coming forward this week. There will be another piece of legislation in addition to Senator Millett's. What will be the difference?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'm a little bit concerned when the senator points out these what I think can be sometimes scary to the public. What she just described happening in the school, I want to point out that Maine is the safest place to live in the nation as it relates to violent crime. I believe we're like 67% lower than the national average. So putting that out there about kids in the school, let's not scare the people into believing that we live in Chicago.
Let me hold that thought, because that is not true for gun violence, though, is it? Specifically for murder and suicide. Our suicide rate and murder rate is about the same as the national average.
No, you have to split the two out.
Okay.
Our homicide rate in the state of Maine averages around 22 to 24 per year, of which half are with a firearm. What brings our numbers up, and something that the other side likes to use, is the suicides by firearm. That's a completely separate issue that needs to be dealt with differently with different policies. So they like to mix the two together to bring the numbers up, but we are a very safe state to live in. And I am bringing forward a proposal. Months ago, I started meeting with the legal staff at the governor's office and with interested parties to examine, and I said in my testimony on the bill that we would be willing to examine our current statutes to find out if there are ways we can improve the statutes and single out individuals in crisis and try to help those individuals to reduce suicides and violence in our communities.
So
we
what's
did that.
The difference? What's the significance difference between the two bills?
Well, what we do is we use the protective custody statute. Officers right now, when an individual is in crisis and they've been identified by police officers as in crisis, they can go into protective custody. We use that system to transition this person into having a review by a medical practitioner to see if they are in crisis. And if that medical practitioner signs off and says, yes, this person is in crisis, they can have their weapons, not just firearms, because you can do harm with other types of devices. They can have their weapons removed for up to 14 days, where they then have a full-blown hearing with a judge. The judge then examines the report from the medical practitioner, the police officer, and that person's history. Based on that meeting with the judge, the weapons can be removed for up to a year. But what we like in particular, and I think most of the people who are going to be supporting this effort like, is that they direct that person into services so that they can get the treatment that they need to get themselves out of crisis. In addition, once during this 12-month period, they can petition the court and say, look, I've got my medication under control. I got my life under control. I want my weapons back, and then they can be returned.
All right. Senator Millett, knowing that this other bill is coming forward, is it something that you could support?
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer. First, I just want to say that I'm pretty sure that the families and religious communities across the country also felt that their communities were safe, the safest place. And there's very little that can determine where there's going to be one of these terrifying acts of violence. I do appreciate the Sportsmen's Alliance coming forward with this bill. I hope that at some point they can, you know, go all the way to support a red flag bill like the NRA has. But this bill, which I think of as the yellow paper bill, deals with mental health law. We have to be very clear. It's not the in crisis, as Mr. Trahan referred to, is not the standard by which this process would be able to be utilized. The individual has to show that they there's probable cause that they are mentally ill, and then also a danger to him or herself and others. So this bill is completely within mental health statute. I do think that this is an important aspect that can be addressed. But, you know, as I testified when I introduced the bill, I don't believe it should be a matter of either or. Red flag bills really do have an important role to play in gun safety. It allows, importantly, family members to petition the court. And when somebody may be experiencing a situation where they're exhibiting irrational or extreme anger or aggression, or they have some bad news about their health, or you know, something where there's not a history or a past diagnosis of mental illness. You know, maybe they're feeling angry from being laid off and having to go through a divorce, and they're feeling hopeless. All these situations would not be covered under the mental health approach that's in the yellow paper language that is being proposed by Sportsmen's Alliance.
Senator Millett, if the bill that you proposed
correct something, though. It's not our bill.
Senator Millett, if you are not able to pass the bill that you've proposed, will you support the yellow paper bill, as you call it?
Yeah, I do believe that it's one avenue to address this particular population. And that what I would hope is that once folks know that this works, that we go back to the red flag bill and pass that, as 8 other states just passed this year across the country.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That Senator Rebecca Millett, a Democratic state senator from Cape Elizabeth. And David, your point is taken that you don't like it to be referred to as your bill.
Thank you.
A bill that many people worked on, including the governor. That's right. And Dimitri, as you listen to this discussion, I'm wondering if there are different constitutional issues that come up depending on whether you're talking about police officers, mental health providers, or family members who instigate the process.
Yeah, I think so many of the constitutional rights in question are in question no matter who is potentially kind of approaching weapons. I think some of them, like searches and seizures, for example, right, that applies when the government conducts a search and seizure. So the Fourth Amendment has its own implications. But certainly from the kind of Second Amendment weapons perspective, the court, in its Heller opinion, explained that there are kind of classic traditional exceptions to the Second Amendment. One of them is for mental illness. And so I think this debate about the two different bills, kind of the further we get away from mental illness, the greater procedure is required. So I think that's where the question really comes in. What kind of procedures are in place to ensure that the person kind of falls within one of the exceptions to the Second Amendment?
And it strikes me that this discussion about these specific bills may have much broader implications for other kinds of proposed laws as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all of these constitutional issues are potentially in play. And, you know, one of the things that the court left open in its Heller opinion is, you know, how do these things play out on the ground? And so the lower courts have really been grappling with all kinds of weapon ownership and public, bringing them to public and concealed carry. So I think there's a lot of implications here from these policies.
Okay, well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from Jenna Maynard with NAMI Maine, and we'll listen to your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ollie's Trolley, offering narrated daily tours of Acadia National Park and Bar Harbor. Learn more at olliestrolley.com. And New England Cancer Specialists, proud to be a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, and committed to helping patients achieve their best outcome.
Polling suggests few Americans want abortion outlawed in all cases, but 1 in 5 are in favor of it being made illegal in most cases. Restrictive new laws enacted by Alabama and Missouri have ignited national debate and set up a legal battle that may challenge Roe v. Wade. Exploring the personal and political, next time on 1A.
1A is tonight at 9 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Television consistently brings us television worth watching, and tonight is no exception. At 10, it's Frontline with Supreme Revenge Frontline. It takes us inside the no-holds-barred war for control of the Supreme Court. From Brett Kavanaugh to Robert Bork, investigating how a 30-year-old grievance transformed the court and turned confirmations into bitter partisan conflicts. That's tonight at 10 on Maine Public Television and available anytime after on demand or through Passport at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Red Flag Laws and those bills before the legislature. Joining me, Jeff Bickford, who's director of the Maine Gun Safety Coalition, David Trahan, executive director of the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, and Dimitri Baum, professor and associate dean for academic affairs at the UMaine School of Law. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Jeff, we were talking about an alternative bill that is likely coming forward this week with the support of Governor Mills. We only know what we've been told about it. We haven't seen that bill. Senator Millett referred to it as a yellow paper bill. Tell me your stance on this.
Yeah, so I would echo a lot of what Senator Millett said. First of all, it's important to point out, and as David pointed out, it's not a compromise bill. Proponents of this bill were not involved in any way in putting together the governor's language or allowed to participate in that process until after some draft language was put together. And it's not a compromise because we don't agree that it takes the place of a red flag bill. I like the senator. I'm very heartened to see that the Sportsman's Alliance and is coming forward, and we can find common ground. The idea that folks in an area of crisis in their life and firearms do not mix, and we're very appreciative of that. We think this is a good way to fix the mental health laws and the blue paper laws. Absolutely. But there should be no question that this is not a red flag bill. It's not a substitute for a red flag bill. It's not a substitute for an ERPO or extreme risk protection order bill. And as the senator said, we should consider both. This works in the particularly narrow window where folks have some kind of a presentable or diagnosable mental illness. But we should also consider those folks that don't rise to that level but are in an area of crisis. And the statistics show that most folks who attempt suicide don't have a diagnosable mental illness. And so we need to address those folks by allowing the family members that know and see them best to raise those concerns with the court.
Calling in now is Jenna Maynard. She is executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Maine. Thanks so much for calling in, Jenna.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jenna, I understand that NAMI, both in Maine and nationwide, takes issue with red flag laws. Can you explain what you see as the problem and how these laws are framed?
Well, I think the Washington Post had a really great article today talking about the fact that we need to stop focusing on mental health when it comes to violence prevention. You know, 1 in 4 Mainers have a diagnosable mental health challenge, and the concept that all of society's violence comes back to mental illness and that we should be, you know, fearing people with mental illness is a lot of what was said during the hearing on this bill. When we recognize that only 4 to 6% of violent crime that is in fact committed by a person who has a diagnosis, does their illness have any causational relationship with that violent act? So, you know, there's a lot we need to do around violence protection and being mindful of supports for people, but there's a couple of really significant concerns that we have with this legislation.
What do you say to those who cite the direct relationship between guns and suicide, and specifically what Jeff was talking about, apparent reduction in suicide, gun suicide, death by suicide in states that have passed red flag laws?
I think it would be interesting to see that data, and not just the number data, but the case review data, which does happen with suicides, to see really the criteria and the factors. What we know in Maine is that Maine leads New England in our middle-aged male suicides. That's actually the population that's most likely to die by suicide using a firearm. And so part of why we have great concerns about the red flag bill is that men who die by suicide in Maine, it's often connected to identity. Either they feel they failed their wives, their children, their parents, they failed in their job. It's about identity, and for the, many of those men, it's just the reality that folks need to understand and accept. Gun ownership is a part of identity. So somebody is struggling, and instead of kind of developing an approach that is culturally competent towards men in Maine, we're just going to take their guns away, which is another core part of their identity. So that raises significant concern.
So, Janice, what you're saying is that you are afraid that if a law like this were passed, there would be people who would not seek mental health treatment because they would be afraid they would have their guns taken away.
Absolutely. I can tell you high-risk populations, you know, we're more likely to lose an officer to suicide than line-of-duty deaths. And many of them don't speak out and ask for help because of they fear repercussions due to the fact that they carry a gun.
Jenna, if you'd hold on just a minute. Jeff, I want you to answer that. I mean, that sounds like a pretty reasonable concern.
Well, I think Jen and I are kind of getting at the same point, which is, well, let me say, first of all, LD 1312, the red flag bill, doesn't stigmatize or go after a particular class of folks because, as firearm owners, we're not targeting them or the bill doesn't address them because they own firearms. It addresses them because they're having a crisis, and the acute nature of having a firearm while in a crisis is particularly dangerous. The lethality of using a firearm as a method of suicide it results in 90% plus in fatality, whereas other methods are not nearly as high. So it's addressing the correlation between someone enduring a issue in their life that may lead them to be a risk to themselves or others with their access to firearms. They're not a subject to a red flag law simply because they have firearms.
Jenna, before we let you go, any form of a red flag bill you would support?
I think the yellow paper bill has a lot more value from our perspective because, once again, we're really concerned once these orders exist, how are they utilized? Are they utilized in child custody cases, in divorce cases? Is that a permanent record? Someone's struggling with thoughts of suicide, and that becomes a permanent record in their life. And so that feels like we're almost criminalizing thoughts of suicide.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Jenna Maynard, the executive director of NAMI Maine, the National Association for Mental Illness. We're going to go now to Dr. Deborah Hagler. She's a pediatrician and vice president of the Maine chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Thanks so much for calling in, Dr. Hagler. What do you think of red flag laws from your perspective as a pediatrician?
I think that they are just one piece of a larger puzzle of helping families struggling with somebody that may be in a crisis. But I think they're an important piece. And I think from the perspective of a family that may be struggling with someone going through a crisis, it gives them yet another way to potentially reach out and keep somebody safe.
Jenna Maynard, as you heard, was just on the line to talk about the concerns from the mental health perspective. As a fellow health professional, what do you think of NAMI's reasons of opposing the red flag bill?
Yeah, I heard parts of that just getting on the line late from patients. And I think the broad spectrum of the extreme risk protection order, you know, there are lots of reasons that somebody may want to do harm. And I think by not making it specifically all about mental health may actually be less stigmatizing. So, because most violence with firearms is not caused by people with mental illness. And I would want to make sure that, you know, that we're not stigmatizing folks with mental illness. So again, it gives families a broader tool, I think.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Deborah. That's Dr. Deborah Hagler, Vice President of the Maine Chapter of American Academy of Pediatrics. We have so many calls and emails coming in. I'm going to start
Go ahead. Could I correct the record, though? Because this initiative that I've been working on with other coalition partners has not been made public, people get to define it based on what they want to say about it. I have the actual amendment in my hand, and I would like to speak to the mental health component for a moment.
Sure.
This does not single out mental health as the only area of concern. I'm going to actually read the language on what the judge is supposed to look at when issuing an order. This is based on the person that the order may be placed against. Recent acts or threats of violence by such persons directed toward himself or herself. Recent acts of unlawful abuse of animals. the reckless use of a threatening display of a dangerous weapon by such person, a history of that abusive use, attempted use or threatened use of physical force by such person against other persons, prior and involuntary confinement of such a person in a hospital for persons with psychiatric disabilities. That's the mental health component. But if you're showing signs of violence, and we've heard many of the shootings nationally, you've heard that these individuals who did the shooting had some of these very same symptoms. We pulled that right from a Connecticut law because we wanted the judges to focus on those indications of possible future violence.
An email from Lisa. I have a friend who committed suicide with a gun. I often wonder if she'd still be with us today if there were a red flag law back then. Suicidal tendencies are often fleeting. Also, a red flag bill would help save lives in domestic violence situations. Isn't domestic violence a big problem in Maine? I'm going to let both you, David, and you, yep. Jeff, respond to that.
I can start with that. Our organization was involved in the current protection from abuse order statute that allows for the temporary, confiscation, I guess you'd call it, of firearms from individuals in a domestic violence situation. We already have a pretty darn good law on the books. I was on the task force that the governor formed, Governor LePage, to look at that law, and we made 11 recommendations to improve our current domestic violence statute. So for this person, that piece is covered, and we can make some significant improvements to it, and I'm certainly open to that as well.
Jeff.
Right. Yeah, it's important to point out that the red flag was drafted and presented by Senator Millett is based in large measure on our existing protection from abuse orders that David was talking about. It's the same process. Again, you have an ex parte process where someone who alleges about in a PFA situation, an allegation of threats or abuse from a partner, and in the red flag context, someone who is exhibiting dangerous behavior towards themselves or others. So the fact that there's Professor Baum made reference to this, the fact that it's an ex parte proceeding and you go before a judge before an order is issued is not uncommon. And in fact, it's the basis of our bill, the red flag bill, is the PFA bill that's long been in existence and has been very effective at reducing domestic violence.
We'll go to Nicole, who's calling from Bowdoin. Hi, Nicole. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I'm incredibly disappointed to hear that the governor has been working with the Sportsmen's Alliance and others to defeat the red flag bill, the excellent red flag bill that Rebecca Millett has written. And I last year I heard her say in many forums that she was proud to support the red flag bill and to have worked on it with Senator Dion. So I don't understand why she's flip-flopping now and wanting to appease the Sportsmen's Alliance instead of protecting Maine citizens.
Okay. Well, Nicole, I don't have the governor with me on the program, but David, really, would you like to speak to that?
Yes, that's really not fair. The legislative process is where good policy is made. It matters what's inside of legislation. What is in the actual statute matters. Rights matter. Due process matters. Our Constitution matters. The governor did support an amended version of Senator Dion's bill 2 years ago. I know because I supported it as well. What it did, and it's also in our proposal, is that people who are ordered by the courts into the outpatient or mandatory outpatient treatment programs, people who have been suffering from chronic mental illness issues and are in crisis, in that case, they can have their firearms removed for a period of time. And that was the governor's amendment. But I don't think it's fair to say that about the governor. There's a process by which everyone gets to weigh in. And at the end of the day, you hope you have a policy that meets constitutional standards. And I would like to speak to a point I made earlier. This bill, I believe, is blatantly unconstitutional in that it issues a simultaneous search warrant in a civil suit with no evidence of a crime. And we have an expert sitting here on the panel. Can you please answer whether I'm correct on that?
Go ahead, Dimitri.
Well, I could talk a little bit about that. I'm less of a criminal procedure expert, but I can talk a little bit about Fourth Amendment, right? So anytime you have a search of private property, generally you need a warrant unless there's an exception that applies, right? And there are exceptions established by the law, including exigent circumstances. And so one of the questions would be, would this process created by the red flag law, would that satisfy one of the exceptions? If it did, you wouldn't require a warrant. Beyond that, to require a warrant, then you do need to have probable cause that something, some crime has been committed, right? And so that could be a potential problem with the law, depending on what the procedure looks like in the underlying hearing itself, how much evidence is produced there of either a crime or to create exigent circumstances.
All right. Okay. And you wanted to say something, Jeff.
Exigent circumstances. Can you please define that?
Well, there's various exceptions under that. So for example, if you have a fleeing suspect, you have evidence that a crime is about to be committed, or someone may dispose of evidence of a crime. So there are many exceptions in the law for when the police do not need a warrant to conduct a search.
Okay. Jeff, I want to give you a chance to get in here.
Just on the piece on the governor's support of this bill, this is a red flag bill, as she described it during her campaign in various formats, online communications. I heard her on this very program back during the campaign discuss that the single piece of gun safety legislation that she strongly supported and that she campaigned on was a red flag bill that included what we have put forward in LD 1312, which is a ability for a family member to go to a court to petition for such an order. She supported that. We are very happy that she is working on this issue and coming forward and understanding that that the blue paper law needs to be updated and cover a broader class of folks who may have access to firearms. But again, that doesn't foreclose her fulfilling her campaign promise to support a red flag bill.
Nicole, thank you for your call. We're going to take another quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Stillwater Environmental Engineering, providing environmental engineering and compliance assistance. StillwaterENV.com.
Presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg went to Harvard and Oxford, but he says the most important item on his resume is where he grew up, South Bend, Indiana.
I didn't even know that it was unusual to have empty factories and empty houses all around you. Then I moved out and realized that that was kind of a defining feature of my part of the country.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Democrat Pete Buttigieg makes his case this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods, co-hosts of the podcast Ear Hustle, join us to talk about what it's like to create audio inside San Quentin Prison. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on KQED.
Join us at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about red flag laws. Joining me, David Trahan of the Sportsman's Alliance of Maine, Dimitri Baum from the UMaine School of Law, and Jeff Bickford with the Maine Gun Safety Coalition. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to a tweet here. The tweet says, "The most complex part of enforcement is recovering the firearm from the potentially dangerous individual. But if a court ordered to take someone's gun away, wouldn't it be probable cause to search premises for said gun? Can't they issue a warrant before recovering?" This is what you all were speaking about before the break. And this is sort of one of the central questions here. Dimitri, you're nodding. David, you're nodding. David, is this related to the case that you were talking about in Maryland earlier in the program?
Yes. What happened in Maryland, I believe it was last November, Gary Willis, a 62-year-old man, had a red flag order brought ex parte without his knowledge from a family member. Police officers showed up at 5 o'clock in the morning. He knew nothing about it, came to his door. He had a handgun in his hand. When he came to the door, he answered it. The officer asked him to put the gun down, which he did. They then issued the order because he was probably in a very confused state, picked the gun back up. And what happened next was the police officers killed him. That is some of our concern around when you're engaging with somebody in their home, particularly they might be confused. The very people that they're talking about in crisis, they may have a mental health issue going on. You come in and you take their guns and then you leave. That's all you do. If you're not getting them the care that they need, you may be making it worse for that individual. They may be very confused, very angry. And they may do something that they might not have done had you used a different process. So it's not only dangerous for the individual, it's dangerous for the police officers as well. And I've heard from many police officers who said that can be a very dangerous situation. The search warrant component, you cannot do a simultaneous search warrant. There is no evidence of a crime. And as far as a person violating the order, if they don't know about the order, they cannot comply with it. You have to, and the courts have said this in their rulings, that you need to give that person the ability to comply with the law. That's a Fifth Amendment violation. And I think that's why we wanted to craft something that the process honored the due process and the constitutional rights of the individual. And I think we've done that. And I think what has been missing here is that not only is our organization engaged, there's a whole community of folks that are engaged that are supportive of the other option, not the current red flag 1312, but going the other route and trying to build on something that we can all support and then also enforce and people can comply with.
I would just point out that the Maine Chiefs of Police supported Senator Millett's bill, and they are supportive of that bill going forward. I can't speak to the language. I haven't seen it. It was done in secret. I have no it's not been released publicly. So I can't speak to what's in that bill or who would or would not support that bill.
Okay. And I was going to bring up that indeed most law enforcement organizations do support red flag bills, but there are individual police chiefs around the country who oppose them. So even within the law enforcement community, there is debate about these bills. We're going to go to Betsy, who's calling from Peaks Island. Hi, Betsy. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. My first year as a school counselor, a teacher was going through a divorce.
Betsy, we're having a hard time hearing you. Can you speak a little closer to your phone?
Is that better?
Maybe. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm in the car. My first year as a school counselor, I was a teacher was going through a divorce. Her teen daughter was very troubled by it. He took her to the doctor. The doctor said first thing to get her help. The doctor said first thing, get guns out of the house. She did, but her ex-husband did not. The teen went there for the weekend, got a gun, and killed herself. And ever since then, I have thought that, of course, it's family members who are in the best position to judge if a person is at risk for harming themselves. They may or may not have any mental health condition, but they're in a crisis. And the red flag bills are designed to address that and address the crisis. And I'm not a lawyer, but it makes, of course they're going to need to search the premises, because if you take one gun away, we'll make, you know, to make sure there aren't any others that could be doing harm. So thank you for taking my call.
All right. Thank you, Betsy. We'll move on. An email from Janet. As your show broadcasts, there's an armed standoff in Auburn right now. We need gun control right now. I'm not sure what the standoff has to do specifically with red flag laws, but it is a reality that, you know, although, David, you bring the point that Maine is safer than most states,
than any state.
We are not in a no one lives in a violence-free area.
Well, one of the issues when you're a free people like we are with a constitution, you have this established standard of rights. There's sideboards against the abuse of government. And when we start passing laws that basically dismiss all of those freedoms, it may feel good to do that right now with firearms. But what happens when that gets broader and it's for all other reasons? Maybe we don't need search warrant and probable cause for search warrant in a whole bunch of other situations. This is a very slippery slope. And once you start down it, I think it can be very dangerous for a free society.
Dimitri.
Yeah, I would just add one caveat to that. Of course, no right is absolute, right? So there's many things in the Constitution, like the freedom of speech and the Second Amendment right, and all of our rights, equal protection. They're subject to kind of inquiry of what is the government's interest? How important is the government's interest? And does that interest outweigh that right? So in this free speech context, while the First Amendment is written in absolute language, there are plenty of exceptions there. The same is true with the Second Amendment. So that's where I think we should focus on as well, about trying to understand what the government's interest is here, and is that interest satisfied? Certainly preventing suicide would be a compelling government interest. And then the question is, does the procedure created by these laws, and I know we're not allowed, I'm not allowed to say compromise, throw something at me, but really every kind of a law is a kind of a compromise, right? We're trying to figure out a way to address violence, address crime, address suicide, and we're trying to find a way to do it in a way that's consistent with the language of the Second Amendment.
A lot of these questions are hard.
Very hard.
That's why you're a law professor. We'll go to Ethan and Sacco. Hi, Ethan. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it. I guess a lot of what I want to say was I agree with the Sportsman's Alliance guy. In fact, I'm in favor of some of the red flag laws. I think that it's probably going to save some lives and help some people. But I'm concerned about about the slippery slope with regards to the Constitution infringement upon our rights. I mean, a lot of us in rural parts in this state and the country believe that of the Second Amendment, the right to protect ourselves from enemies, foreign and domestic. And, you know, I know a lot of people in the cities don't really understand that part, but that's part of a very deep part of American beliefs, and it's part of the Constitution. But I'm also concerned as we talk about this subject, when we got to get down to facts, and some of the things in recent history, some of these shootings, I mean, we're not even really allowed to get all the facts from them. And some of them, I mean, I'm confused, like that in Las Vegas. I mean, I was an anthropology major, and I did some forensic anthropology, and some of the statistics, some of the things that they were telling us just didn't add up in my mind. And, you know, I mean, we gotta get down to fact. If we're not even allowed to ask questions about some of these shootings, and by the way, they are tragic. And any loss of life is tragic, but and especially some of these school shootings with children and stuff. But we have got to get around that issue. If we're not even allowed to talk about some of the problems with the lack of facts with some of these school shootings and stuff. So, the last thought I had was ever since the Parkland shooting, I've been in favor of advocating for more gun safes in homes, because a lot of the shootings are accidental shootings and with guns that are not in safes. And I know that might be tricky to do too, to enforce people to just put their lock their guns up, keep the ammunition away from the guns.
Sure, Ethan. We've got a bunch of calls we're going to try to get to before the end of the hour, but I saw both of you nod when Ethan was saying more safes.
Yeah, yep. Well,
something to agree on.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had submitted a number of pieces of legislation related to firearm safety. One of them was a sales tax exemption for gun safes. And that did pass. It's sitting on the appropriations table. We're going to use that as an incentive-based program to encourage people to buy safes. Our members do get serious discounts from retailers. So you combine the two, and you can get a gun safe pretty cheaply. And Jeff did help with that. He testified in favor. And it is a place of mutual interest. I do want to correct a point around suicide for a moment. Jeff pointed to Connecticut and Indiana as a place where suicides by firearms went down slightly. Although that is true, the suicides by other means increased. So one of the things that I would do, instead of trying to challenge him on that and one argue against the other, I believe we should be looking at why they're committing suicide and how can we get to them sooner so they never get to the place of using any device to commit suicide. So I think that might be a place we could talk as well.
Yeah, I agree. Attacking the issue at its core is always helpful, and then hopefully you get to a point where you don't have to worry about methods, but that's a long process, and we certainly support that. And just on the safe storage issue, you know, part of what our goal is in our work here at the Maine Gun Safety Coalition is we raise money to buy and distribute free trigger locks. In our 20 years of existence, we've distributed over 25,000 free trigger locks so that people can safely secure their firearms in their home, prevent accidents, prevent suicides, prevent the weapon from being stolen and used in the course of another crime. That's a very important part of what we've done. And we're very proud of the fact that we know purely by those numbers that we've saved lives with that trigger lock program.
We have an email from Joel. My question, as a dad with children in Portland schools, will the red flag law help roll back the active shooter drills in schools? Will any policy help us give up these drills?
Well, that's a great question, and I'd love to jump in and answer that. One of the bills that we did submit, I've been working on now, this is David Trahan from SAM, for 7 years, actually, to when I was a state senator, was to increase security at Maine schools in a fair and equitable way. Many of the I call it wealthier, but just they have a higher tax base. Towns, Cape Elizabeth, Portland, bigger school districts have instituted some pretty good security measures at their schools. There are many rural and suburban schools that haven't. Studies showed that. We submitted a bill to establish a school safety center. Patrick Corey introduced it. That bill did pass, and the Department of Education got a grant to create it. We're hoping that that entity will improve security statewide for all schools.
Yeah, and those are great steps to take to secure schools. And I think Dave and I both agree that arming teachers is not the solution, but securing schools is.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, we'll go to Jeremy, who's calling from the Portland area. Jeremy, we're almost out of time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Sure. So my question is, I'm not really familiar with the language of this bill, but it doesn't sound like if someone is red flagged and their weapons are taken or their firearms are taken away, that they'll receive any sort of services post-fact. And I'm wondering why that wasn't part of the bill. And then my second question is, if it's just firearms that are being removed at the time, why aren't other weapons also being removed at the same time?
Okay, Jeremy.
Yeah, so I'll just both those
Jeff?
Points.
Yeah.
First of all, because of the nature of courts and the way that courts now interact with people who are suffering from crises, be they something that rises to the level of mental illness or below that, they are plugged in and have a tremendous volume of resources, albeit taxed, that can direct people to programs. And part of what the court order would do after the red flag order is served is that the court would say, I believe, based on the information in the reports, you need this help. I would like to see this or attend this program, go to outpatient counseling, something like that. So there absolutely would be a component of that. As to why firearms are covered as versus other weapons, it's, as I mentioned before, the lethality that comes with attempting suicide with a firearm or in using a firearm to engage someone else is much higher than other methods.
Jeremy, thanks so much for your call. We're almost out of time. And Dimitri, I just want to turn to you for a final word here. What are you watching in Maine? What are you looking to see? And what are some of the, what will you be studying going forward based on what Maine does in the legislature this session?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the interesting issue is looking at the success rates at other states, looking at models from other states and see how they've done. You know, I think both of these laws that are kind of out there potentially have some constitutional concerns. I think both of them have some merits to them. And so really studying them, I think both probably satisfy the kind of Second Amendment Heller muster. And so it really becomes a question of politics, of which law would actually prevent more violence and more death.
All right. Well, thank you all three for being here today. The voice you just heard, Dimitri Baum, professor and associate dean for academic affairs at the University of Maine School of Law.